Hello and welcome to the reading of the Courier, the e-edition, for Thursday, December 7th. I am your narrator, Peter Welch, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Services Network for the Blind and the Disabled. So I hope all of you are doing well out there, and I am looking here at the front page of the Courier here, the e-edition. Let's see what we've got here. The first article I'm going to read is Coats for Kids, Giving the Gift of Winter Warmth. There's a big shot here in the front of the paper with a fourth grader who's trying on a pair of snow pants provided by Coats for Kids on Tuesday in Waterloo. Let's see what we've got here. Let's read this article. Becker students choose coats, boots, snow pants during organization's visit. Some Fred Becker Elementary School students will have a cozier winter thanks to a visit Tuesday from the Coats for Kids campaign. Julie and Bruce Ehlers started Coats for Kids in 2012, providing 180 coats to students from low-income families. Over the last 11 years, the organization has given nearly 21,000 winter coats, boots, snow pants to students at 34 schools in Cedar Falls, Evansdale, Gilbertville, Hudson, and Waterloo. This year, the goal is to help at least 1,800 children from preschool to high school across Blackhawk County. At Becker Elementary cafeteria, tables were piled with coats and snow pants for students to choose from and try on. First grader Maya Johnson, age 6, was excited about the coat choices. "My favorite color is pink, but I also like blue and purple," said Maya, who was able to choose a galaxy print style puffer coat and matching pink boots. "I love snow and can't wait to make some snow angels." Surveying the students picking out items, family support worker Tina Smart stressed just how important programs like Coats for Kids are for children within the Cedar Valley area. "The gift of having a warm coat is like Christmas for these kids. They're able to play outside with their friends without having to worry about staying on the blacktop," she said. Leah Elizendra, age 9, shared just how excited it was to get a new pink coat. "I felt like I was shopping. I had so much stuff in my hand," she said. "Sometimes my family and I go on walks, and I can't wait to take a walk in my new coat." Leah's classmate, 8-year-old Kylie Harris, also is happy with her new items. "Getting new stuff today was fun," she said. "The coat I had before I didn't like because it was too bulky, and I didn't like the way it looked on me." Kylie was very proud of her shiny pink and silver coat that she was able to pick out. "I can't wait to go out for recess," she said. Donations are accepted year-round to make the winter gear purchases possible. A gift of $30 allows a child to choose a new warm coat, along with hat, gloves, and a scarf. A gift of $50 covers a new coat, hat, gloves, scarf, and a pair of boots. For $70, a child gets everything needed to play in the snow: coat, boots, snow pants, hat, gloves, and a scarf. Contributions can be sent to the Waterloo Community Foundation, and here's the address for that. You send it to the Waterloo Community Foundation, Post Office Box 1253, Waterloo, Iowa. And the zip code is 50704. Okay? And let me just, I'll repeat that one more time. Waterloo Community Foundation, Post Office Box 1253, Waterloo, Iowa, 50704. Let's see, and you can also go online if you want to, and I'll spell this for you, uppercase W, then L-O-O, Community Foundation, all one word, .org. Under the Give Now tab, learn from about the organizations online at facebook.com. And that would be COAT, that's capital K-O-A-T, S, the number 4, Kids, K-I-D-S, dot Waterloo. Simon wins council seat in Waterloo at large race. He beat council member Greeter with 60% of the vote. While lining up his pool cue to shoot the eight ball on his last round of pool with friends, Steve Simon found out that he would be the next at-large member of the city council. Simon received 60.43% or 2,553 votes in Tuesday's election, according to unofficial results from the Blackhawk County Auditor. His opponent, current Ward 2 council member Jonathan Greeter, received 39.5% or 1,669 votes. There were three write-in votes. Playing pool with friends and later celebrating at the other place on Ridgeway Avenue with his campaign staff, Simon said that his large group of friends is what made his campaign successful. I think that's an asset. That's going to help me on the city council because I have friends in all places, Simon said in a phone call after the polls closed. I'm going to utilize my friends and the knowledge they have, and I'm going to capitalize on that. During the regular election in November, Simon received 2,923 votes, about 45% of the ballot cast. Greeter won 2,194 votes, or almost 34%. The other two candidates, Corey Holmes and Ashley Chapel, received 13% and 8% of the ballots, respectively. Since none of the candidates received more than 50% of the votes, a runoff election was required. All right, let's see. What else do we have here? Let me also tell you that today it's going to be mostly sunny, and it's going to be a high of 54 degrees, but you might also keep in mind that if you're going a little further south in the Des Moines area, it's going to hit the big 6-0. Good heavens. But it's going to cool off again over the weekend. All right, we'll talk about that a little later down the road. Let's see what else we've got here. Waterloo man gets 26 years in prison for drug charges. A man involved in an organization that moved large amounts of methamphetamine to Waterloo has been sentenced to federal prison. Judge C.J. Williams on Monday sentenced Jesse Lee Red Lax, age 38, to more than 26 years behind bars during a hearing in U.S. District Court in Cedar Rapids. Following prison, Lax will be on supervised release for 5 years. Authorities allege that Lax met Daniel Mamajars in 2015 or 2016 while they were both serving in time at a Colorado prison. Mamajars now lives in Mexico, and authorities allege he runs a drug trafficking organization that has transported huge quantities of meth and other drugs to Waterloo in recent years and may be affiliated with the Sinaloa cartel, according to court records. In 2019, Mamajars arranged to have Lax and his then-girlfriend, Sandra Ann Darrell, drive to Detroit to pick up 3 kilograms of heroin, according to court records. Lax and Darrell later moved to Waterloo at Mamajars' request, where Lax began selling heroin, cocaine, meth records state. Lax also made trips to Cincinnati and Bell's Gardens, California, to obtain pounds and quantities of cocaine and ice meth that were then mailed back to Waterloo. In January of 2020, Lax went to a West 5th Street apartment in Waterloo to pick up his girlfriend. He was asked to leave, and he shot another man in the neck, according to court records. The victim survived. Court records allege that the shooting was related to meth. When police searched Lax's home in connection with the shooting, found a receipt for $1,000 money order that Darley had sent to a person in Sinaloa, court records also state. Lax was arrested for the shooting, and Darrell took over his role in the operation, court records state. Tripoli man sentenced to prison in sexual attacks. In Tripoli, a Tripoli man has been sentenced to prison for 2 sexual attacks in 2022. Tracy Vern Buchholz, age 52, pleaded to 2 counts of assault with intent to commit sexual abuse in Bremer County District Court in August, changing his mind as his jury trial was underway. On Monday, Buchholz was sentenced to 4 years behind bars, which will be followed by 10 years of parole. plus victim restitution. You will also have to register as a sex offender and following prison and submit a DNA sample. The cases were investigated by Detective Jason Ellison of the Bremer County Sheriff's Office and prosecuted by First Assistant County Attorney David Thompson. Both cases involved attacking women in broad daylight in public places. Man faces gun charges after Sunday high-speed chase that ended in a crash in Waterloo. A Waterloo man has been arrested on gun charges after allegedly leading police on a high-speed chase that ended when he crashed into another car Sunday. Police arrested Dejon Jarrell Stokes, age 30, of 1125 North Barclay Street, for felon in possession of a firearm, eluding, and possession of a controlled substance. Bond was set at $20,000. According to authorities, a patrol officer pulled over Stokes Chrysler Pacifica in the area of Lafayette Street and Linden Avenue around 9:30 p.m. Sunday. The officer asked Stokes to step out of the vehicle because he smelled marijuana. Stokes drove off. The ensuing chase reached speeds up to 90 miles an hour in a 30-mile-an-hour zone until the Pacifica hit an occupied vehicle. Stokes ran a short distance before he was detained. Officers found a loaded 9mm Taurus on the Pacifica's dashboard. Stokes has a prior assault conviction from an apartment holdup in the parking lot of West 9th and Washington Streets in August of 2021, where one of the robbers was shot and killed. Apartment complex eyed for empty lot on Kimball Avenue. 48 one-bedroom units will be constructed behind AutoZone KFC. In Waterloo, a lot that has remained empty for years will soon be the site for dozens of apartments. The City Council approved a site amendment for the property behind AutoZone and KFC off of Kimball Avenue on Monday. Prairie Rapids LLC plans to construct a three-story building with 48 one-bedroom apartments on the grassy area. This building will be the second phase of the Prairie Rapids project, developed by High Properties of Cedar Rapids. The first phase, located at 150 Rapids Square, was completed in 2018 and is made up of 512 complexes. That complex is 100% occupied, with monthly rents averaging $1,000, according to city documents. The new building is expected to rent below $1,000 per month. The second phase site is just over 2 acres, and the project is estimated to cost $5.5 million. The initial phase received a workforce housing tax credit. The city also provided funding of $1,000 per unit through its Waterloo Housing Improvement Program. The council also approved a resolution to include a city limits urban revitalization area partial tax exemption scheduled for the project. It would last 10 years, starting with a 80% tax exemption in year one and ending with a 20% tax exemption in year 10. CFU received 68 general manager applications. Cedar Falls. The top job at Cedar Falls Utilities has attracted a lot of interest. The Board of Trustees received 68 applications from people looking to become the 10th general manager in the municipality utilities history. According to Chairperson Dick McAllister, a vast majority met the minimum qualifications and were from the upper Midwest. The person would replace Steve Bernard, who's planning to retire sometime between March and June at the age of 62 after a 36-year career in the utility business, 28 of those with CFU and more than 5 at the helm. We were presented with a really good pool of applicants when nowadays when you're filling a position, you're not sure what you're going to get because of the way the job market is, McAllister said. Applicants had backgrounds and outside the utility industry and spanned the public and private sector. That's a reflection of who we've hired in the past, he says, while noting past general managers have not followed the same career path. He declined comment on any specifics about the applicants themselves, including whether they were internal candidates, citing that information as part of the confidential record at the request of the applicants. The trustees were in a closed session for approximately 9 hours Tuesday for initial interviews and evaluations of applications, or applicants, I should say. And there's a picture here of firemen putting out a fire, destroying a camper trailer parked on Forrester Avenue in Waterloo on Tuesday. Let's take a look at this. Fire engulfs camper, man and dog escape in Waterloo. Waterloo man and his dog escaped injury when their camper trailer caught fire for Tuesday morning. Chris McCacken said that he had fallen asleep in the Chevrolet pickup truck parked next to his camper, located in a forested lot off of Greenwood and Forrester Avenue, and awoke to flames shortly after 8 a.m. McCracken started up the pickup and pulled away from the burning camper, but heat from the inferno scorched the side of the vehicle and melted the exterior door handle and other plastic fixtures. Behind him, the flames engulfed the camper. A passerby on U.S. Highway 218 saw the fire and smoke and called 911. Everything was in there. I had a guitar in there, said McCracken, a musician, as he watched Waterloo firefighters pick through what was left of his drum set and other debris to find lingering hot spots. The official cause of the fire hasn't been determined. McCracken said that he was heating the camper with an electric radiator heater. The property located in the former Sherwood Park neighborhood along the Cedar River, much which has become government buyout land following the 2008 floods. McCracken's father owns the lot where the camper was parked, which is one of a few privately held parcels in the area. Man whose semi found on highway still missing in Des Moines. David Schultz's semi-truck was found 2 weeks ago on a rural highway in northwest Iowa, its trailer still filled with baby pigs he was transporting. Schultz's wallet and phone were inside, and his jacket was on the side of the road. But Schultz was nowhere to be found, and his November 21st disappearance outside Sac City remains a mystery. His wife said something must have gone wrong, calling the 53-year-old father of two a dependable man with a strong work ethic. "This is not something David would do," Sarah Schultz told the Sioux City Journal. "He would never leave. His family is his life." Hundreds of people have volunteered to search for Schultz, but after scoring 100,000 acres near the highway, the effort was paused as searchers consider their next steps. Leaders of the search were convinced that they would have found Schultz if he had wandered off because of a medical emergency or some other problem. Iowa's Division of Criminal Investigation is assisting the Sac County Sheriff's Office and the Lakeview Police Department in the case. Iowa DCI referred the Associated Press to the Sac County Sheriff's Office, which declined to comment on the active investigation. Schultz of Wall Lake didn't arrive as expected with a load of pigs on the 21st of November in Sac City, a small farming town about 90 miles rather northwest of Des Moines. The section of the Courier, we are now on the opinion page. My view. The first article I've got here on another view is from the Las Vegas Review Journal. And the title of it is "Impossible is Happening for Medicaid. Enrollment falls for a government program that's supposed to be last resort for needy." Former President Ronald Reagan once noted, "No government ever voluntarily reduces itself in size." And that's true, which is why what's currently happening with Medicaid is so remarkable. During the pandemic, Medicaid's enrollment grew dramatically, because the federal government tied increased emergency funding to a provision, rather, that prevented states from removing ineligible individuals from the rolls. Medicaid enrollment ballooned from 65 million people to more than 94 million people earlier this year. That's more than a quarter of the country's population. So much for Medicaid being coverage of last resort for the neediest. Reagan foresaw that outcome. The rest of his above quote states that the government program, once launched, never disappear. Actually, a government bureau is the nearest thing to eternal life we'll ever see on this earth. To prove his point, the White House kept renewing the emergency order even as the pandemic faded. This was a backdoor effort to permanently expand Medicaid. But Republicans in December of 2022 rescinded the continuous coverage mandate, forcing states to disenroll those who were improperly using Medicaid. Progressives, eager to see more Americans become government dependent, warned that enforcing eligibility requirements would lead to a massive spike in the uninsured. Well, that hasn't happened. As the Wall Street Journal noted in August, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services project to less than 1% point increase in the number of uninsured Americans once the pandemic emergency provisions expired. Although the Medicaid enrollment is expected to decrease significantly, CMS concluded, many individuals who were not disenrolled from Medicaid during the public health emergency already had comprehensive coverage from another source, such as through employer, and thus remain insured even when disenrolled from Medicaid. The process is working. Already more than 11 million people have been disenrolled. Again, enrollment standards haven't changed. States are now simply confirming eligibility, and also removing those who no longer qualify. In addition, safeguards are in place. An appeals process retroactive coverage for those inaccurately removed from Medicaid because of bureaucratic mistakes. If Democrats want to debate about expanding this entitlement program, fine. But etching temporary pandemic emergency provisions in stone isn't the way to go about it. Cleaning the rolls by enforcing eligibility provisions will, Reason.com noted, save taxpayers an estimated $80 billion annually. Even for the government, that's real money. Well, that was an interesting thing to read. Let's see, what else do we have here in the My View section of the paper here? Congress right to expel without a criminal conviction. This is written by Jonah Goldberg, who's editor-in-chief of the Dispatch. George Santos, the infamous fabulist, got the boot from Congress last week. First member to be expelled in over 20 years and one of only three members to be kicked out for something other than fighting for the Confederacy. Santos was the only representative since the Civil War to be removed without first being convicted of a crime. Bribery, to be specific. That's not enough space here to recount all of the allegations against Santos, which include 23 federal charges, including fraud, identity theft. What seems clear is that Santos was a bit like Max Bielstock, the main character from The Producers. Bielstock thought that he could bilk investors, or in Santos' case, donors, on the assumption that no one would inquire about what he did with their money if the Santos show bombed. But Santos won his Long Island congressional race, inviting scrutiny that should have been applied when he announced his run. Still, some of the standing athwart Santos' defenestration yelling, "Stop," make good points. Dan McLaughlin in National Review and Byron York in the Washington Examiner both argue that expelling House members without a criminal conviction will have unintended consequences, and it's not just conservatives. Adam Serwer, a liberal writer for The Atlantic, agrees that Congress deciding for itself whether voters have made a mistake could lead to more members being expelled for things that they are only alleged to have done. It's important to note that no serious person defense handles on the merits. While their points are well taken, I nonetheless dissent. In almost any other institutions, a business, a university, newspaper, law firm, etc., the question of whether to fire someone doesn't normally hinge on a criminal conviction. Let's say you're a boss of an employee accused of myriad misdeeds, from making up his resume to criminal fraud. You wouldn't fire the employee based on mere rumors. You'd conduct some kind of investigation. If that investigation provided evidence to your satisfaction, you'd fire that employee. You wouldn't wait possibly for years for a criminal conviction. Well, of course, Congress is different. Members don't work for the House. They work for their constituents. One advantage of holding off on expulsion is that a conviction provides a clear, neutral, limiting principle. The editors of the Wall Street Journal rightly note, "What's the rule now?" they ask. How about enough facts to satisfy two-thirds of the House, which is what it took to oust Santos? Expelling Santos was an act of political repair, not destruction. Yes, it violated a longstanding and defensible norm, but the decision was forced by the breakdown of other norms. For starters, Santos is a shameless fraud who had no loyalty to norms of conduct. He also took advantage of the breakdown of basic notions of journalistic and partisan due diligence. If the natural biofilters of the political ecosystem aren't working, Congress can and should charge, or excuse me, should change, rather, excuse me, change its standards when toxic sludge sluices into the chamber. One of the great sources of dysfunction in American politics is the refusal of Congress to take itself seriously. Removing the unserious Santos is a small first step. One of my biggest peeves about the impeachment of debates of the last quarter century centered on the same argument used to oppose Santos, expulsion, that the only just standard for impeaching a president can be found in criminal law. The idea that a president must be proven guilty of a crime beyond a reasonable doubt to be removed from office is a nonsensical standard. It's also cowardly because it allows a member of Congress to abdicate all responsibility to apply their judgment. The presumptions of innocence standards is right and proper for criminal cases because the convicted can be deprived of life and liberty. But impeachment, like expulsion, merely deprives a politician of a privilege to hold power. I'll worry about the unintended consequences when someone under serving loses that privilege. Yes, indeed. Okay, we are coming up to the first half hour of our broadcast here, and I'd like to remind you that you are listening to the reading of the e-edition of the Courier, and this is Thursday, December 7th. This was, of course, the day of Pearl Harbor. And my name is Peter Welch. I'm your narrator, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Independent Service Network for the Blind and the Disabled. Before we go on here, let's take a look at our obituary news, and then we will go from there. The first one is Emogene Edna Batt, has passed at the age of 85 of Cedar Falls. And I'm looking here to see if there are any memorial services here. Here we go. The funeral service for her will be 11:30 a.m. on Saturday, December 9th, at St. Paul's Lutheran Church, which is at 513 Clay Street in Whitmore, Iowa. Visitation will be held on Friday, December 8th, from 5 to 7 p.m. at College Hill Lutheran Church, 2322 Olive Street in Cedar Falls, and also at 10:30 a.m. before the funeral on Saturday. Burial will take place in St. Paul's Lutheran Cemetery in Whitmore, followed by a luncheon at the church. Robert Leslie Ross has passed at the age of 95. I'm looking for. Oh, here we go. It's a memorial service will be held at St. Tim's Methodist Church at 3220 Terrace Drive in Cedar Falls. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Illinois Legal Aid Online in Chicago, Illinois, St. Tim's Methodist Church, Cedar Falls, Iowa, or Fremont County Historical Society in Sydney, Iowa. All right, let's see what else we've got. We have Gilbert Glasson, Dr. Gilbert F. Glasson, has passed at the age of 99. Wow, that's a long life. A funeral mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Tuesday, December 12th at St. Edward Catholic Church. Invitation from 5 to 7 p.m. Monday, December 11th at Lock at Tower Park at 4140 Kimball Avenue in Waterloo, with a 5 p.m. rosary and 7 p.m. vigil service, also for 1 hour prior to mass at the church. For more information, you can dial 319-233-3146. Dorothy Van Gundy has passed at the age of 85. And let's see what her, okay, here we go. Funeral service will be at 11 a.m. Friday on December 8th at the Nazareth Lutheran Church, Larson Chapel. The invitation will be from 9:30 a.m. until service time at the church on Friday. Memorial contributions may be directed to St. Croix Hospital or Hospice, St. Croix Hospice or the church. Okay. All right. Now, let us go back and continue on where we left off. We just finished the opinion column. Let's take a look now at the next section of the paper. This is the North East Iowa Area Escapades. Here are just a few of the events and goings-on that are worth checking out this week in Northeast Iowa area. Okay, let's take a look here and see what we got here. Saturday, the 9th of December, Songs of the Season in Great Hall, Bell Canto Cedar Valley, the Jesse Cosby Community Collective, and Cedar Falls High School Concert Choir will be featured in the A Bell Canto Christmas Songs of the Season concert at 2 p.m. on Saturday. Concert will be performed in the Great Hall at the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center in Cedar Falls. And tickets are available at, and I'll spell this out to you, it's Unitix. That's unitix.uni.edu at the GBPAC box office located at the Strayer Wood Theater, or you can call them at 319-273-7469. I want to repeat so you don't get confused. It's Unitix, unitix.uni.edu. That is the full address there. And you can also go to the GBPAC box office located at the Strayer Wood Theater. Or you can call them at 319-273-7469. Thursday, December 7th through Sunday, December 10th. Happy holidays for Bluesville. Harry Connick Jr.'s The Happy Elf ends its Cedar Falls Community Theater run at the Oster Regents. Performances are at 7 p.m. tonight and Friday at 2 p.m. Saturday and Sunday at the theater at 103 Main Street. It's about Yubi, the elf, who is stuck sorting naughty, nice mail for Santa at the North Pole and discovers every kid in Bluesville is on the naughty list. Tickets are $27 for adults, $12 for kids. Available online at mycfet.org/the-happy-elf, and at the box office. And you can call them at 319-277-5283. Saturday, the 9th of December, self-guided holiday pub crawl set. The downtown Waterloo bars of Christmas pub crawl Saturday. Slip into your ugliest holiday sweater, you know, the one with the reindeer antlers and on cats with jingle bells, you get the idea, and participate in the self-guided pub crawl. Funds raised will support future events and activities presented by Main Street Waterloo. Tickets are non-refundable, and they are available at the Main Street Waterloo .ticket spice.com. Let me spell that out for you. It's Main Street Waterloo, all one word, dot tickets, TICKETSPICE.com /Waterloo-12-bars-OF-Christmas. Boy, that's quite a that's quite a mouthful. All right, what else do we have here? On the 11th of December, which is on a Monday, a New Horizons concert is set. The UNI News Horizons Band's holiday concert is from 7:30 to 9 p.m. on Monday at the Great Hall at the Gallagher Blue Dorm Performing Arts Center. Alphorn soloists Lisa and David Lang, retired band directors from Independence, will perform with the band. A reception will follow. The band features musicians ages 50 and older. And on the 10th of December, which is on a Sunday, the Proud Image Chorus once again joins forces with the River City Chorus from Mason City to present a benefit concert at 3 p.m. Sunday at Cedar Valley Church, 3520 Ansboro Avenue. The Christmas concert will benefit House of Hope and features many favorite carols. Tickets are $10 for adults, $5 for students. Available from chorus members by calling 515-979-9054, or you can go to the internet. And here's how you let me spell this out to you. It's HOUSEOPECDOT/EVEN-T, then registration, all one word, .org/index, and I is uppercase 1378. Monday on the 11th of December, celebrate Christmas with Lori Line. Lori Line fans can celebrate her 34th annual Christmas tour at 7 p.m. Monday at the Oster Regents Theater at 103 Main Street. This year, Line is presenting an elegant all-new solo piano show with a new vocalist. Tickets are $60, available online at www.lorie, let me spell that, L-O-R-I-E-L-I-N-E, all one word, .com/tour. Available tickets will be sold at the door beginning 1 hour before the show. And what else do we have here? A very dairy Christmas on the 9th of December, which is on a Saturday. And it's Have a Very Dairy Christmas. That is the name of it. A Very Dairy Christmas is Saturday at Hanson's Dairy Tour Center in Hudson. Guests can choose from two sessions, 1 to 2:30 p.m. or 3 to 4:30 p.m. Only 75 tickets will be sold for each session. Tickets are $20 for ages 13 and older, $15 for ages 3 to 12, and free for kids 2 and under. The tickets are available online only. And again, I will spell this, Hans, let me just spell that, HANSENDAIRY.com. This family-friendly event will include a visit and photos with Santa, holiday sweets, a locally sourced holiday charcuterie spread, plus a chance to create an ornament and see a dairy calf up close. Well, all right, let's see. Let's do one more here. On Sunday, the 10th of December, Metropolitan Choral to perform. Light Out of Darkness is the theme from the Metropolitan Choral Holiday Concert at 3 p.m. on Sunday. The concert is at 3 p.m. at First Congregational Church at 608 West 4th Street in Waterloo. Admission is free. Free will donations of cash or non-perishable food items will be collected for the Northeast Iowa Food Bank. Well, that's certainly a great cause. Okay. All right. Let's move on. Let's see what else is going on here in the e-edition of the paper here today. All right. How Republicans are planning for the caucuses. in Des Moines, Iowa. Republicans will gather in just over a month in schools, churches, community halls to cast their vote for the presidential nomination and kick off the national primary process. The high-profile presidential caucuses require meticulous planning, from state and local officials to secure locations, organize volunteers, and get the word out to voters. The caucuses are held across more than 1,600 local precincts every 2 years to organize party businesses, but attention and attendance surges in years when there is a contested presidential nomination. We take great pride in the fact that we are well organized and that we do participate it to be highly successful with great activity for registered Republicans, said Polk County Republican Party Central Committee member Chris Werman, and it's an important step in democracy. Iowa Democrats will hold party organizing precinct caucuses on the same day as Republicans on the 15th of January, but they'll express their presidential preference using a new mail-in process and won't announce results until the 5th of March. The changes came after National Democrats booted the state from the early nominating spot in an effort to redesign the calendar in a way that better represented the party's demographics. For the Republican caucuses, voters will gather at 7 p.m. January 15th at designated precinct locations. Before the presidential preference poll, representatives from each presidential campaign can make speeches in support of their candidates. Attendees will then cast their vote for a president by writing a name on a slip of paper. Those votes are counted and reported to the state party. Once the vote is over, caucus attendees will then move on to party business, like electing delegates to the county convention and proposing items for the party platform. Okay, and this is a very, very long article. So I'm just looking at some of the other things I might want to read to you here. New DeSantis aide, a new ad from Florida Governor Ron DeSantis' presidential campaign features a series of Iowa voters explaining why they support him over Donald Trump, urging voters to move on from the former president. One voter, identified as Christine, calls DeSantis drama-free, an effective and proven leader. Ross Postian, a former state representative and Scott County supervisor who has endorsed DeSantis, is shown in the ad saying, "We've got to move on from Trump." The ad is part of more than a $2 million buy in the first in the nation caucus state that will run through January 15th, caucus day. The previous ad from the campaign featured clips of Governor Kim Reynolds announcing her endorsement of DeSantis. Okay. Yeah, things are heating up there. And they're going to get hot, folks, as we go down the road. It's going to be quite a year for the nomination of the President of the United States. All right. Let's turn now to the weather. Talk about up and down. Right now, we're probably getting close to 54 degrees, and that will be the temperature that we're going to have today. It'll be mostly sunny. And then tonight, it will cool off. It'll be about 37 degrees. And then Friday, mild with periods of sun, a high of 54 and a low of 33. Then things cool off a tad on Saturday, becoming windier and colder with a high of 39, a low of 20. Sunday, it will be sunny, but it'll still be chilly, high of 36, a low of 18 degrees. And the outlook for Monday will be mostly sunny, a little bit warmer, high of 41 and a low of 23. And other forecasts that I looked at said that things will probably be somewhere in the mid to high 40s most of next week. National forecast, as a storm continues to press eastward today, snow showers and areas of steadier snow will extend from the high ground of the Pacific Northwest to western Wyoming and Montana. Rain, some heavy at times, will again soak those close to the coast in Oregon and Northern California. Snow showers will affect part of the interior Northeast. Boy, oh boy, we could sure use some of that wet stuff, couldn't we, here in the Midwest? All right, let's now go to the next section of the paper. This is the 360 degrees section of the paper, and it what it pretty much does is it covers world events and national events. And let's take a look here and see what all is going on today here in the paper. NIR, Oz was ground zero. That's NIR, Oz, OZ was ground zero. Okay, let's take a look at this. What does this mean? Kibbutz, embodied attackers, hostage strategy. In Israel, the Hamas attack on the kibbutz of Nur Oz started a little after 6:30 a.m. on the 7th of October and lasted long into the afternoon with dozens of militants rampaging unopposed through the community with an apparent mission to capture as many civilians as possible. By the time the last militant left, one of five residents of Nur Oz was a hostage. The remaining resident emerged from their safe rooms and gathered together in a shelter, spending the long night toweling the mission. 8 weeks into the Israeli-Gaza war, the recent release of dozens of Israeli hostages, with as many still in captivity, is bringing new focus on what Hamas did on October 7th, the day its fighters rounded them up from communities across southern Israel. The kibbutz of Nur Oz, where militants rampaged unopposed, is perhaps the best place to understand Hamas hostage strategy, an operation unprecedented both in its scope and execution. More than 100 Palestinian militants stormed Nur Oz on the 7th of October for hours and left with some 80 of its roughly 400 residents. People from Nur Oz made up a third of the 240 hostages taken in all, and nearby half of the Israelis released, with more than 30 still in Gaza. For Israelis, Nur Oz embodies their country's vulnerability. That day, with the absence of Israeli security forces, the capture of unprotected civilians, their deaths and disappearance into Gaza, and their subsequent exchange for Palestinians. The men who shot out the guard post at dawn on the 7th of October were the first of about seven groups of armed fighters. They carried out their plans relentlessly as messages flew back and forth on the kibbutz chat and WhatsApp's groups. 9:16 a.m. How do you lock the safe room? 10:15 a.m. We are officially hostages. 10:19 a.m. They are threatening to blow up the house if we don't open up. One by one, people dropped out of the flow of messages. Some later appeared in Hamas videos. One terrified mother clutches her two red-headed toddlers as they are led away in a blanket, her eyes huge with fear. A boy is hauled away from his armpits. An elderly woman is pulled to her feet after tumbling off a motorcycle. Those seized from the kibbutz ranged in ages from 9 months to 85 years. More than half were women and children. All 13 Israeli hostages released in the first exchange on November 24th were from Nur Oz, and they bought the freedom on 39 Palestinian prisoners from Israel. A review of hundreds of messages among Nur Oz residents shared exclusively with the Associated Press, direct interviews with 17, and accounts from many more, security camera footage and Hamas' own instruction manuals suggest that the group planned well ahead of time to target civilians. For experts in hostage situations agreed with that Hamas actions, both on the day of the attack and afterwards, indicated a plan to seize civilians to prepare for the war to come. Danielle Gilbert, a political scientist at Northwestern University who researches hostage taking, said that Hamas and other armed groups generally use hostages as human shields or as currency to negotiate and exchange. But the difference here, she said, is that most of the armed groups take able-bodied adult. New rules clamp down on aerial tours of U.S. parks. Fewer planes and helicopters will be flying tourists over Mount Rushmore and other national monuments and parks as new regulations take effect that are intended to protect the serenity of some of the most beloved natural areas in the United States. The air tours have pitted tour operators against visitors frustrated with the noise for decades, but it has come to a head as new management plans are rolled out at nearly two dozen national parks and monuments. One of the strictest yet was recently announced at Mount Rushmore and Badlands National Park, where tour flights will essentially be banned from getting within a half mile of the South Dakota sites starting in April. "I don't know what we're going to be able to salvage," complained Mark Sheffley, a co-owner of Black Hills Area Adventures, who is looking for alternative routes. The regulations are the result of a federal appeals court finding 3 years ago that the National Park Service and the Federal Aviation Administration failed to enforce a 2000 law governing commercial air tours over the parks and some tribal lands. The schedule was crafted for setting rules, and many are wrapping up as of now. But now an industry group is eyeing, bear with me, turning the page here, is eyeing litigation, and an environmental coalition already has sued over one plan. Critics argue that the whirr of chopper blades is drowning out the sound of birds, bubbling lava, and babbling brooks. That, in turn, disrupts the experiences of visitors and the tribes who call the land around the parks home. "Is that fair?" asked Kristen Brengle of the National Parks Conservation Association, noting that visitors on the ground far outnumber those overhead. "I don't think so." The air operators argue that they provided unrivaled access, particularly to the elderly and the disabled. "Absolutely exhilarating, a thrilling experience," is how Bailey Wood, a spokesman for the Helicopter Association International, described. The article is quite lengthy, and I have to finish here because we are out of time, folks. So I would like to remind you that this is IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Services Network for the Blind and the Disabled. This is December 7th. We are reading the e-edition of The Courier, and my name is Peter Welch. I am your narrator. I want to thank you for listening here. We will talk next week. Take care. Bye-bye now.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Shortly after modern humans arrived in Europe, the Neanderthals disappeared, and scientists think we had something to do with it. Neanderthals, or their direct ancestors, migrated out of Africa and into the Middle East and Europe around 250,000 years ago. Soon, they were well adapted to the environment. Large eyes helped them see in the longer nights and darker winters. Stout bodies helped them retain heat and handle large prey, and provided space for the large liver and kidneys needed for a diet heavy in protein. Their brains were as big as ours, but spent processing power on their greater visual and motor abilities. This may not have allowed them to develop higher communication or conceptual thinking to match ours, which may have been their downfall. Modern humans arrived on the scene 45,000 years ago, less physically adapted, but more mentally adaptable. We had cooperative hunting methods superior to the Neanderthals, allowing us to outcompete them for food, and perhaps reducing the large herbivore populations that they depended on. We also had superior tools and weapons. When there were conflicts between the groups, as there have been among tribes throughout history, our superior technology probably allowed us to prevail. But we weren't only fighting. There must have been considerable interbreeding, since we can find 1-3% of the Neanderthal genome in modern man. Which means the Neanderthals never completely disappeared. A little bit of them is alive in us today. I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.
In Africa, 5-year-old Charu has no choice. She and millions like her must walk miles every day for dirty water. But together, we can end their walk by providing clean water close by. Instead of spending hours walking to get water that makes them sick, girls can be in a classroom that expands their minds, and moms will gain back time to care for their families. Sons and daughters can grow up strong, finally free of sicknesses caused by dirty water. At World Vision, care about clean water runs deep. Deep enough to reach one new person with clean water every 10 seconds. Because every child, every person, everywhere deserves clean water and the chance to rise to their full potential. It's true. When you just add water, you change a life. Learn more at worldvision.org.